The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Some of the different aspects of how the contextualization discussions got where it has gotten. And we talked last week about the difference between contextualization and digitization. And what I want to hit next is the impact of Bible translation and the effect that this has had on this kind of discussion. Now for this you're going to need your Hebrew Bibles. Did you bring them? You didn't bring your Hebrew Bibles. Did you hear that, Dr. Dillard? All right, everybody with a Hebrew Bible gets an automatic A. Not a single one, Dr. Dillard. Okay. Well, that's tough. To use your Greek. All right, turn with me in the Greek Old Testament. I always get those mixed up. But another a key stream in the of influence in the discussions has come from this whole question of Bible translations. How on earth do you get from Bible translations to something as abstruse as contextualization? I think the answer is because of the fact that really Bible translation, to get it done, especially in the last three decades, has created kind of new paradigms or ways of understanding language. And indirectly, that has had a big, heavy effect on these discussions. You have noticed probably already, in terms of some of the class discussions and reading, that when we've talked about some of the leading thinkers and evangelical writers in this whole area, they always end up being linguists or anthropologists or something. People like Charles Taber, Charles Kraft, Eugene Nida. These are the big names in the evangelical community in terms of contextual theology. And yet all these people are linguists or they're trained cultural anthropologists. Well, how then did they happen to get in the middle of all of this discussion? I mean, it wasn't that they were sitting there one night and they just turned off the late show and said, now what can we do till Johnny Carson goes off the air? I know, let's invent a new discussion. The point was is that in a real sense, the Bible translators have been doing authentic contextualization for decades now. And in particular, the Wycliffe Bible translators. But the significance of their work has really not been fully felt in the areas of theology. Why hasn't it? Well, because the church isn't interested. Wycliffe Bible translators, to the average person in the pew, or even to the average pastor, well, those are those people that come through every 4 or 5 years and tell us all those neat jungle stories. Marilyn Laszlo tells us about eating grubs and evangelizing men wearing G-strings. We get to watch all those neat jungle picture stories that we missed at the last Urbana. But I think there's a lot of truth here that we have to recognize. Usually when we think of Bible translation, we translate it in terms of our agendas into, sort of PR stories of heroic jungle missionaries. That's dangerous. Because what happens is the real impact, cognitive, the emotional, the real life-changing impact of their work is usually left them totally out of the cold, out in the cold. The impact of their work is left for another culture. So again, we have no direct opportunity to reflect on what they're doing and the significance of what they're doing for our work. But that's now changing. And one of the reasons it's changing is because at least in the English-speaking world now, we have tons of English Bible translations. in the last 20 years, how many Bible translations have we got? Boy, oh boy, it's almost, I would guess, almost impossible to calculate anymore. When I was a student here in the 50s, you know, about the only one you had was the King James Version, and there were occasional kooks like Dr. Clowney who used the American Standard Version, which was done in 1901. Nobody even knew that it was being printed, you know, but Dr. Clowney read it. And we all knew it was odd because it kept saying Jehovah instead of Lord. Then the only other translation that was available, and that was very suspect then, was the Revised Standard Version. That had just come out about 1940s. And evangelicals didn't use that because it messed up Isaiah 7:14. So in the 50s, all we had really in effect was the King James Version. Now, since that time and now, we've got certain English language versions that have become almost standardized. The New International Version, and just before that was the New American Standard Bible. They are now virtually competing with the King James Version for the place of authority. Then you've got all the other individual translations. You've got the Berkeley Version. You've got the J.B. Phillips translation. You've got the Good News for Modern Man. You've got the New English Bible. I mean, you've got all kinds of choices to make now. And as a result of that, what's happening is that people are now, at least in the Western world, are now being forced to ask tougher questions than they've ever asked before. They're now asking, for example, why is this translation better than that one? When we talk about faithful Bible translation, what do we mean by that anyway? Is the New International Version more faithful than the New American Standard Bible? Tell me the difference.
Why do we use faithful?
I think probably, Anise, what they usually mean by it is this English translation faithful to the original Greek or the original Hebrew? Okay, you're already giving one of the answers to the question. you're ahead of us all. Hang on just a second. The reason I raise the question that way is because precisely because different people are going to answer it differently, and that's one of the answers, but there are several other answers as well. And just the very fact that people are now struggling with what does that question mean? I'll give you a sample. Some years ago, a man by the name of Kenneth Taylor, he was an editor for Moody Press, and every day he lived in Wheaton, Illinois, and every day he would get on the train and he would drive into Chicago and work at Moody Press as an editor. He had a large number of children. I think he had 8 or 9 children, I think, big family. And he would have, every night, he would have family devotions. But he began to be very frustrated because his children couldn't understand the King James Bible, all the Old English, and he wanted to make his family time important for his children. So he decided on the train, it takes about an hour to get from Wheaton to the real world, and he decided on the train that what he would do would be he would translate the King James Bible into English that his children could understand. And that's how he spent his time driving into Chicago and going back to Wheaton. Now, over a period of years, he finished the translation of the letters of Paul, and he published them as a small book. Then he went on and finally, eventually, became so successful that not only did he do this for his children, but he proceeded to expand the translation and eventually came out with a complete translation, what we now call the Living Bible. Now, that Living Bible was produced by Kenneth Taylor just for his children, for their benefit, so they could understand the Bible studies that they had in the evening in the home. Now, a lot of people, most of us, I suspect, do not regularly use a copy of the Living Bible in your Greek or Hebrew classes. When, for example, when you're comes time for the Hebrew examination and you're going to memorize the English text, you will probably turn to the New International Version because that's the best translation to memorize, right? Oh, sure. Well, if you're more conservative. See? Okay. All right, there's part of my question. We will usually refer, when we're doing that, to the Living Bible as a paraphrase. Is the Living Bible a translation or a paraphrase? That's usually the question asked. And the answer is why it's a paraphrase. But you see, that assumes certain things. Tell me the difference between a translation and a paraphrase. What do we mean, for example, when Rosemary tells us that the NASB is more literal? What do you mean more literal? More literal than what? What's literal? And all of these questions start asking questions, you see, that are much deeper. Now, people like Charles Craft and Tabor and Eugene Nida are taking these questions, and what they have done is they have sort of they're drawing lines between the principles of Bible translation and questions of contextualization. And they're taking the models used for contemporary Bible translation and then transposing them into discussions of theology. For example, the really big name in contextual theology is Charles Craft. I hope sometime we can get Chuck here on campus to talk to you. His brother may be more well-known to some of you. His brother teaches patristics at the University of Pennsylvania, Robert Craft. You may have had to read some of his essays for New Testament studies. A very strong liberal critic at University of Penn. Anyway, Chuck has, in his book, Christianity and Culture, has talked about dynamic equivalence theologizing. And if you've even read a little bit into my massive thing, you notice this language pops up several times. Now, this language comes from linguistic theory. Craft was a trained linguist. He has his PhD in linguistics from Hartford Seminary. He taught linguistics at UCLA for a number of years before he went to Fuller Seminary. But he's using the model called dynamic equivalence from linguistic theory and applying it to theology. The idea behind that is this is a paradigm. This language represents a paradigm shift for doing translation. The previous model, which was in place for many years in terms of Bible translation, was something that, for want of better terms, we can call formal correspondence. These words represent two different ways of doing Bible translation. The formal correspondence model and the dynamic equivalence model. The current one is this. This is the one utilized by the Wycliffe Bible translators. If you want a little more background on this, Dr. Skilton edits a series of books called The New Testament Student. Do you know that series? And a few years ago, he edited a book called The New Testament Student and Bible Translation. And it consists of a series of essays of interchanges between Dr. Dillard and Noel Weeks, and then Dr. Dillard and somebody else, and then Dr. Dillard and somebody else. Sort of, you know, Dr. Dillard against the world type of book. It's a fascinating thing. Ian Murray has a chapter in there. When you read the essays, read them as a dialogue between these two models of translation. So Ian Murray, for example, to my mind, represents roughly the formal correspondence model. Noel Weeks represents the formal correspondence model, and to a much lesser degree, but still gently, Dr. Skilton. Whereas Dr. Dillard is over here with the dynamic equivalence thing. But if that'll help you identify a little bit of what this is going on, you might want to read that collection of essays from that point of view. Let me, just to help you, review some of the difference between these two models, just talking about language, because it may help us to catch the meaning of all this better. And I want to give you about five or six differences between formal correspondence and dynamic equivalence. All right, and you'll need your Bibles for this one. Number one, I want to use some illustrations from the scriptures. Will? This really is, you almost can't do Bible translation today. This model just dominates the whole field. I think Vern, for example, has had a lot of, of course, working a lot of this from the point of view as well of structuralism and, modifications of structuralist ideas. And that's another dimension to it. But right now we're just sort of very starkly kind of contrasting the two things. Okay, number one, formal correspondence models. Simply transfer the word forms of the source language into the corresponding word forms of the receptor language. And I'm using technical terminology, but I'll try and explain it. All right, once more. Formal correspondence simply transfers the word forms of the source language, Greek, Hebrew, into the corresponding word forms of the receptor language, English, Spanish, Portuguese, French, Korean. So, for example, a fairly simple one, but the only ones I can do. All right, here's the Greek word splunkna. That is Greek, isn't it? That looks a little Hebrew to me, but it's all Greek to me. Anyway, now the Apostle Paul uses this Greek word splunkna, and he uses it in a couple of places, for example, in Philippians. Let's take a look at Philippians chapter 1, verse 8. And I hope some of you got different translations. Philippians chapter 1, verse 8, and Philippians chapter 2, verse 1. Okay, Philippians 1, 8. Somebody want to read us that and tell us what version you're reading from? The reason I mention this all is Philippians 1:8. They all seem to go for the word affection. I think New American Standard Bible did it, and so did the New International. God can testify how I long for all of you with the affection of Jesus Christ. And then the same term is used, in Philippians 2:1, the NIV reads, if any tenderness and compassion. So the word which in Philippians 1:8 is affection becomes tenderness in Philippians 2:1, same word. And what was the word, what was the closest to it in the Berkeley one, Rosemary?
It's affection Bark. In both.
Affection in both.
Affection and compassion.
Okay. Now, the Greek word is this one. How do you translate that word? Bowels, intestines. That's what the word means. I think the King James versions uses the term bowels,
yeah.
Right?
I have a King James.
Ah, please read that for us.
For God is my record, how greatly I long after you all in the bowels.
Okay, it's very straightforward. In the bowels of Christ. Now it's an anatomical term. And now tell me, is an NIV a good translation or a loose one? Is it a paraphrase? What do you think? The Good News Bible, for the same one, uses the phrase deep feeling. The Jerusalem Bible, God knows how much I miss you all. Now, that's the formal correspondence notion. Formal correspondence notion would be the King James Version, where the word literally means bowels, so you literally translate it bowels. I think Kraft diagrams it this way, better than using terms like literal. Let's do it this way. Here's what's called your source language. Here's your receptor language. Here's the Greek, here's the English. All right, what we're talking about is this kind of process. And this is the process of formal correspondence. A in this language equals A in that one. B, C, and D. By way of contrast, for dynamic equivalence argues for the priority of meaning over form. Dynamic equivalence argues for the priority of meaning over form. So, for example, the New International Version. It's Lankna, it translates as affection or tenderness, or deep feeling. What they're wrestling with is meaning, as it were, not just a formal kind of slogan type terminology. Okay, that's one difference. Second one. Formal correspondence models. Try, insofar as possible, to regularly render every given word in the source language more or less consistently by the same term in the receptor language. Okay, once more. Just basically the idea of they try to be very consistent. So if they catch this word in the source language, like the Hebrew or Greek, they try more or less, as much as possible, as consistently as they can, to translate it by the very same term in the other language. For example, let's take another sample. Soma. Okay, how do we translate soma? Now, the Revised Standard Version and the King James Version basically translate that word soma as body, no matter where it occurs. So it's body for example, in Matthew chapter 6, verse 25. Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear, about your soma. Same kind of language, for example, in Mark chapter 5, verse 29. This is about the woman with the issue of blood. Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. There's the word body again. Luke chapter 17. Verse 37. 17, verse 37. This is about the vultures, etc. The two women grinding and then one taken. And the disciple asks, you know, when will this happen, Lord? And the Lord replies, where there is a dead body, there the vultures will gather. Now, I won't go into this, but this is the New International Version has just extrapolated on the text. The word in the original Greek there is just simply the word soma, not dead body. Just reads, where the body is, there will the vultures be gathered. Okay, now, the defense of this kind of position about formal correspondence then usually hinges around the idea of being consistent. Is this the consistent translation that's used throughout? Now, by contrast, dynamic equivalence models, they argue for the priority of contextual over verbal consistency. In other words, both of them agree there should be consistency. But the formal correspondence notion is pushing verbal consistency, formal consistency, whereas the dynamic equivalence model is arguing for contextual consistency. Are you consistent with the context in which the word's put? So, illustration. Even the word soma, then, gives us different meanings according to the context. And you cannot literally translated anywhere and everywhere, body, and have an accurate translation. Or at least not as good a translation. So, for example, Mark 5, verse 29. Again, a lot of these modern translations, they don't just sort of consistently follow these things down the line. Whenever you're working with translators, it's, you know, five of one and half dozen of the other. As Dr. Dillard is fond of saying when he worked on the NIV, you know, how do you determine whether this translation is the Word of God? You flip a coin. Mark 5, verse 29. Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. Any other way you could translate that? How about? Okay, so they use body too. Was yours Berkeley? Any possible alternatives?
It means, who shall deliver me from myself, characterized by my very nature of sin? Who shall deliver me from this self of sin? That's what he's talking about.
Well?
Yeah.
I think, for example, the instances I just gave in Romans 12, in a real sense, soma, as I read it, is another shorthand term in Paul's anthropology. It's just another way of talking about yourself. And Paul basically uses two terms to describe a person. Sometimes he talks about soma, sometimes he talks about psuche. But either of those terms are not terms used to indicate 50% of who I am. Either of them is another full way to talk about me as a person. Only when Paul's sort of looking at me in terms of what I'm going to do out there in the world, in terms of my function, my service, my witness, my love towards the world, then they talk about soma. But when he's talking about sort of me viewed from the inside out, then he talks about psuche. But they're not two different, they're two different terms for the same thing. Carol?
I think it's interesting when you talk about
that. Well, okay, third difference. We talked about this a little bit last week, so I won't go into it long here. Formal correspondence theories operated on a 19th century paradigm of the nature of language that was idealistic. Now this model of language, basically this concept, basically saw language as alternative codes that were just simply different labels for the same reality. So the assumption in this model is that words were kind of brute facts. They always existed in abstraction from the context of their own philosophical and cultural worldview. So remember Dr. Ventil, he'll talk a lot about idealism, and he'll talk about this idea of presuppositionlessness, Voraussetzungsloschigkeit. You know, when he used to be here, he would write the whole word across the blackboard. It took a whole blackboard to do it. But the idea of the idealist was that, you know, words are just sort of come at you like cold things. They don't have any meaning packed into them. They're just existing out there as separate brute facts. And so in Dr. Ventil's books in apologetics, frequently he talks so much about brute facts and about idealism, because he's trying to link these things together. Now, in language, it looks like this, in language theory. All right, let's take a look. Here's culture A, and here's culture B, and here's culture C, okay? We'll do it this way. The cultures are different, right? Now, behind this all, you see, is the assumption that though the cultures have different shapes, the grids are the same. So that, you know, if you've got little grid words, little nets, bites of words over here, even though the culture is different from this one and this one, you can still just sort of transfer. You know, you pull out your little component out of this transistor and you can stick it into that component. And then when you're done with that one, you can put it in that one. Okay? Because you see, all these components are, you can isolate them from that whole culture. You can pull them out. They're separate. So if you've got enough radios, you know, you can keep on using a radio forever. All you do is just pull out one. When one piece burns out, you know, just replace it with another. Now that's formal correspondence. As an illustration of this kind of thing, it strikes me that the discussions people have over whether the Living Bible is translation or paraphrase is a good example of very often it, behind that discussion, or those the assumptions behind that discussion, are certain presuppositions that people already have about language. When somebody says to me, I think the Living Bible is a paraphrase, my assumption is this man or woman has adopted an idealistic concept of language. And they have this notion that you can transfer things simply, because the Living Bible is a little slippery and loose. It must be paraphrased. It can't be exact proper translation. Doesn't quite fit into the idealistic concept of language. But the problem, part of the problem is, tying it in with the point we made before, is you want to be as consistent as possible. But the problem is, should you be consistent to just the verbal form of the word itself, or rather, should you make sure that that word is consistent with its own context? Because in terms of its context, that verbal form on that page, that soma, may have a very different meaning. It's different, for example, when the Lord says, where the soma is, there will the vultures be gathered. That's different from where Paul says, present your soma as a living sacrifice. Paul doesn't mean present your dead corpse as a living sacrifice. That's the exact opposite of what he means. He says, you're a living sacrifice, different from the Old Testament. So the point is that you are struggling constantly with trying to figure out what does this word mean within the living context? And to recognize that meanings are given to the same verbal symbols that are different. For example, I think we did this last week, but we can try it with another word, even in English. Please, fire away. Usually, my impression is, where you have a distinctly formed culture, you have with it as part of the apparatus its own language. Well, I think probably what would happen, what the argument would be, is you're not dealing with a separate idiom, you're dealing with different culture. And there are ethnologists and linguists today who'll argue that Black English is a separate language.
Yeah.
And so it represents a separate culture. I think that's going kind of extreme to my mind. Maybe you could call it a subculture, just as White English has become a subculture, only because the majority are whites, that's now standard English. If you want to get really technical, you can find as many definitions of culture as you can of theology, depending on who's writing the definition. But I think there's a generally accepted kind of definition, and that is that culture is those normed patterns of behavior that are learned, both learned and unlearned, by which a human society functions, thinks, dreams, analyzes, operates. So it's very comprehensive kind of thing. Well, language is one of the keys. But it's sort of back and forth. I don't think they'd say language is a key that unlocks it, but they would certainly say, in terms of modern language theory, that that your language is like a window. And you can look through the window and you see the culture. And not only that, there are some linguists more recent who argue language even shapes the way you look at the world. It even fashions the way you look at your culture. You've seen that. Look at the change, for example, in words we use to describe the homosexual. When I was a kid, we talked about homos and faggots and gay and fairies. I would not recommend going into some bars on Sansom Street and trying that. Now, though, we can use the term gay, which is apparently acceptable to both the homosexual community and the straight community. Now, that's more than just a label. That is a way of looking at the homosexual. Just as the word gay, this is the word faggot or fairy, was a way of looking at the homosexual. It was a pejorative term. Gay isn't. So even the words affect how you begin to look and evaluate a community. Look at the way in the abortion discussions. The labels we put on ourselves are intended, the purpose of the labels is to help us evaluate how we, not only how other people see what our position on abortion is, but how we ourselves look at it. So it's pro-life or pro-choice. And the words themselves immediately start mentally kind of creating the boundaries around which you're going to find the problem. I think that's part of the struggle here. Does that help any?
Yeah.
You know, this is why, for example, in a foreign mission setting, this is why it's so crucial for anybody to get the language. This is the first thing you've got to do. You don't go out to work in India and then work there for 20 years before you decide to learn the language. You don't go to Uganda and say, well, the official language is English, I'll just work with my English for the next 10 years and get around to it. You cannot do that. Because what you are missing then is a window by which you can perceive the whole way a culture works and functions. And I don't know how many missionaries I've seen make that mistake. Literally. Well, the Lord's coming soon, we don't have time. Or, well, I can speak English and there's so many Koreans who can understand English. All kinds of good reasons, but of course the problem is that by doing that, we have totally misunderstood, have the right nuances. Your primary concern is, will the person who's now listening to you be able to perceive the good news through the language you're using to him? And so you must be willing to shift to his or her ground in terms of using their language to communicate the gospel. That's basically what a missionary does when they decide, hey, I've got to learn Korean, I've got to learn Syrian to communicate. Right, is the same thing goes on when you may have to use in English other terms or language. I think it would depend on where that person was, on how blunt a person I was talking to. I might even use language stronger than adultery.
Yeah.
You have to evaluate that. It would be the same, I think, the same way if well, I might as well use this. Concrete with prostitutes. Now, what language, what term do you use when you're talking to a prostitute about her job? About five or six terms in the Korean language you can use.